My topic tonight is what the heck are we doing? Or insight meditation. What, why, and how? And if you've been coming here for a while or listening to Dharma Talks elsewhere, you have probably heard a lot of what I'm going to say. And I hope you don't mind any repetition. My experience as a student has always been and still is that repetition doesn't do me any harm, particularly now that my memory is going. But I like hearing the same stories over. I like hearing the lists over and over, because every time I hear it anew, I'm at a place where I can absorb more. Tonight I'm going to try to tie together a lot of these things that you may have heard in different contexts. And I'm hoping that even if you don't hear anything new, it'll give you a slightly different view of what insight meditation is, what it is that I'm suggesting you do when I give these instructions. There are lots of different kinds of meditation out there. I just met someone last night. She asked what I do. I told her. She says, oh, I have a good friend who's a Buddhist. And I said, well, what flavor? And I went through, you know, Theravadan, Mahayana, Tibetan Buddhism. And I said, well, finally, well, what does she do? What kind of practice? And she says, the mantra over and over. I'm really embarrassing. I don't know it. But it's Nichiren Buddhism, and that is a form of meditation, to say phrases over and over. We do it with metta. Every day there are new forms of meditation. What I teach because it's my practice, and I'm qualified to teach it. And I have adopted this practice because it works for me. And I have seen it work for other people. And it comes pretty highly recommended by this guy named Buddha, who called it the direct path to enlightenment in a sutta called the Satipatthana Sutta. And there won't be a quiz. You may have heard this sutta referred to as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And I'll touch on those, but very lightly, I hope. We call it insight here in the West and in English because, for two main reasons, it's looking inward and it offers a new way of seeing things, you know, a new understanding or even an epiphany, although that's not guaranteed. Insights are always, they always come as guests. You can invite them, but they don't show up until they're ready. So we can't expect that, but it is a nice bonus of the practice. The point of this practice that Buddha laid out is transformative by nature, because it changes the way we see things over time. Even if we don't get these aha moments, it will change the way we see things. And the beginning is right at the beginning, when we first start to meditate. To change our way of seeing in a very fundamental way, the eyes and the brain look out and they see what reflects light back to the eyeball as solid, separate, enduring things, nouns. And they're not. They're not. Physics has taught us this. What they are is energy. And then Higgs boson slows them down and they acquire mass. You know, so it's sort of like energy and time get together and, okay, so that's it. If you understand that, you're way ahead of me. But Buddha, here's the thing, Buddha understood this over 2,500 years ago. One of his fundamental teachings is that all things are of these characteristics of separateness and solidity and endurance over time. Everything changes, he taught. And what physics is telling us is that it's all process. And it's all a related process. We're all interconnected. In fact, it's one unified process of which we are a part. So we really are connected. When we see things, as mostly we do, from this thing-centered point of view, and mostly we see ourselves that way, it warps our understanding of what's going on here. It leads to delusion and suffering. And you may have already heard that the cause of suffering is clinging or greed and aversion or fear, anger, hatred. And this, as I said, it warps things for us, especially when we see ourselves as, you know, separate and solid and enduring. And all of those things out there is the same, because it all gets related to what things I want and what things I don't want. And insight meditation, right from the beginning, introduces a new relationship with our true nature, with ourselves. And we begin to see ourselves, I mean, right away, we begin to see ourselves as embodied awareness, which is very different, usually, than all the stuff that I think I am. Just awareness. It's in a body. This practice also is intended. That's where it's pointing. And its job is to build increasingly continuous mindfulness in the practice, and I think more importantly, outside of the formal practice, in our lives. And at the point that the mindfulness is 24/7, then the practice has culminated in awakening. The first of the four foundations is the body. The body that is the host of the awareness. And when we bring our attention into the body, we immediately begin to have a better understanding of what our awareness is. I've taught so many intro to meditation courses over the years, and I know how many beginning meditators don't know how to feel what it's like to be in a body. And so in my instructions, I always start with that. I always try to offer words that will direct your attention to the experience of the five senses, and particularly the tactile sense of the body. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, Buddha offers many ways to pay attention to the body, different postures and activities, but probably the most important one is the breath. And typically, that's what we pay attention to in meditation. There are other ways to do it. So if that's a real problem for any student, I'm always happy to teach the traditional or even non-traditional alternatives. I have a dear friend who just told me the other day, I've known for 15 years that she has a really hard time watching the breathing. She's just realized that's because she's asthmatic. And she never knew that all this time. But, you know, in our interacting over and over the years, she's finally broke down that resistance to realize there's a reason why it was so hard for her. So I urge you to watch the breath as a bodily sensation and to get into the awareness of the body from the inside as thoroughly as possible. When you're able to direct your attention to the breathing and it stays there for any length of time, that's concentration. And it's very helpful, rather than to try to force the thoughts out of the mind or shy away from them, if there's something that you can put your attention on with some appeal, or something that isn't as boring as the idea of breathing, which the body does. I mean, we can take it over. I don't recommend that you do in meditation, that you just watch the body do its job. But most of the time, most of us are content to let the body take care of that. We've got more important things to do. But it's a good idea if we can take interest in the body. And I find it much more interesting when it has the multiple dimensions of physical sensations. And I can just sink into watching how it feels to breathe. And when we do that, we're not spending our meditation session imagining what it's like to breathe. We're actually watching. In order to start developing concentration and then mindfulness, the very first thing that we have to do is stop. We have to stop the momentum of our activity. We have to depart from our daily life. We don't have to go tell our father we're leaving, leave our wife who's recently had a kid, give away all our worldly possessions, shave our head, put on a robe, carry a bowl, and go out into the wilderness. But we do have to depart from all of that in the moment. Just stop valuing everything else more than meditation. For this period of time that you set aside to meditate, let meditation be the highest value. Let that be the thing that you're doing. And everything else, you've stopped. You've come to a rest. You're at peace. At ease. You're in a kind of seclusion from the world that's just for your practice. You're getting in touch with your real nature. And the natural improvement of your state of mind that comes from that. So I've mentioned interest as something that helps build concentration. If we can be interested in the breath, that will help hold the attention there. Another thing that helps is pleasure. And it comes as a surprise to some people that you're supposed to enjoy this. You know, it's not supposed to be drudgery. It doesn't need to be dreadful. We can make it that way. But there's a lot of pleasure to be had from watching the breath. You know, unless you're in denial about your asthma or, you know, other things. And particularly when the attention does settle and rest on the breathing, there's a great feeling of pleasure. And I'll talk about that a little more later. And the third tool of concentration is effort. And I've been doing this about 10 or more years. When I went to Gillen, I said, I think it's time for me to develop some concentration. And, you know, I take it very gently, you know, but what do you suggest? And he said, well, why don't you try a little harder? And by goodness, it worked. So that's always a last resort. If the interest and the pleasure aren't working, then we can try. But as I said the last time I was here and talking, you don't have to try to latch on to that concentration like an angry dog, you know. Just the effort needs to be balanced and nuanced. And it's not what it's all about. We just need enough concentration for mindfulness to arise. Acceptance is something that needs to come into play very early on also. And that is acceptance of the fact that concentration doesn't come easy usually, unless you're enjoying it, unless you're interested in it. And thoughts will come up, even though you don't want them to. And they will take you away. And they will dump you off very often in an uncomfortable place. And when you come to, your body's kind of all tense and unhappy. And we need to just accept it, because that's the truth of the moment. And there's work to be done in that moment. And I'll talk about that a little more later. But what we're doing when we learn to accept the truth of the moment is that we're opening our hearts. Accepting what is the seed of love. We know this with the people in our lives. If we don't accept them for who they are, we don't really love them. It's a big part of what love is about. And sometimes this is something that a relationship really needs to work on over time, is this acceptance. And so, you know, we have the opportunity in our practice every time we meditate to develop that capacity for acceptance. It's also an essential element of the mindfulness practice that Buddha laid out. It's one of the states of mind that Buddha said we need to do this practice with in order for it to be transformative. We need to be without desire and discontent, have a choiceless awareness. Now, desire and discontent, I mentioned just a little while ago, as the sources of suffering. Greed, aversion. When we're without that, we're accepting. We're at peace with what is. I said just a moment ago, we don't need to push thoughts away. We just need to turn the attention to the breathing, because that takes energy away from discursive thought. And it can't go on very much without that energy. the energy of our attention is just wonderful. And again, you know this with the people in your lives. When you pay attention to them, they bloom. When people really pay attention to you, it feels really good. This is an energy. It's a very essential energy. And thoughts, discursive thought, can just drop away when we take that energy away from it. And by discursive thought, I mean that train of thought kind of mental activity which mimics speech. Sometimes there's a kind of sub-vocalization that accompanies it. Often it leaves out words, or it doesn't follow any rules of grammar. It may involve reasoning or not. It usually sticks to a subject, at least until it veers off onto another. If we bring enough attention to it and we apply logic, then it can solve problems. I'm just trying to give you an idea of what I mean when I say thought. But the vast majority of the thinking that goes on in our minds just distracts us from the immediate experience and gives us an energizing case of the jitters. Gil Fronsdale calls this the caffeine of the mind. When we do sit down and take energy away from discursive mental chatter, those of us who are sleep deprived often slide right off into dreamland. And that's okay. We can accept that. It's all right if we take a little Vipassana nap. So if we can approach the presence, the absence of discursive thought with acceptance, without judgment, the attitude would be, oh, look, there's thinking. Or, oh, yeah, there's worrying again. Or, oh, that's a cookie. Or ice cream. Or, you know, whatever it is that pops into our heads. Or it could be, oh, there's a hot, sharp sensation somewhere in the body. Just noticing and accepting. This judging that we do so readily is the grown-up form of the second foundation of mindfulness, which is really hard to see. I was in my sixth or seventh year of practice on a retreat for quite some time before I was able to see it. It's an instantaneous arising of desire or of aversion. It's just a like, don't like. It's very subtle. It's a seed of liking or not liking. And it grows up and it becomes judgment. And we can't stop that immediate response. It's called Vedana. But we can take our energy away from the judging. So once we feel our breathing and can come back to it, we begin to see the third foundation of mindfulness, which is the mind. And at that point, we should be able to look at it and to pay attention to it, but not by just going off in the train of thought. The breathing continues to be our anchor of awareness. We just come back to it over and over again. And so when a thought arises, it's not then just, oh, a thought, or oh, worry, but yeah, worry about that same old thing, or this thing that's come up, or anger over what. So we're able to recognize what's going on in the mind. And if we're not judgmental, then we can look and see how it's affecting us how does it feel in this body, which was so peaceful and relaxed and pleasant when we were mindful and at peace? And how does that compare with the way the body feels after we've been chewing on a resentment or worrying or planning? If we can let ourselves sink in to the experience of the body as a result of that thought, we get to study suffering in the laboratory, where it's safe, where we're safe, where we're not going to misbehave, we're not going to accrue karma, we're not going to have apologies to make to friends later. We can really come to understand our buttons, our emotional responses, and what causes this. And we get to start experimenting again in the lab with taking that energy away from it and putting that energy onto something that's wholesome, that is helpful to us in our lives. This is called wise effort. Turning the attention away from the causes and the conditions of suffering and turning it toward the causes and conditions of this wonderful mixture of peace, love, and joy that accompanies mindfulness. So this process of coming to understand suffering and how it is caused is gradual. It comes from our doing this over and over. And at about this point, we start to move our practice, the traditional term is off the cushion, outside of formal practice and into our daily lives, integrating our practice with our life. And in these intro to meditation courses, I like to introduce this right away by encouraging moments of mindfulness in our daily activities, like picking a daily habit, like toothbrushing or dishwashing or driving, and try being mindful of it whenever we do that, instead of just automatic. See how it feels in the body. Notice our responses. Grab what I call meditation moments on the bus, in line, while we're waiting, while we're looking at a view or noticing a flower. Pick some neutral part of the body, like hand, foot, nose, or knee, or the breath, and check in with it over and over. And feelings are a wonderful thing because they tap us on the shoulder. Big ones definitely come to us, we'll notice it, but unfortunately, usually we're swept away with them. So we need to practice paying attention to the medium-sized feelings. And again, check out the way they cause the body to feel. And keep practicing opening the heart with the practice of dana and generosity. Not just here in the Sangha, but out on the street. And the divine abodes of love, acceptance, loving other sentient beings. So that our practice can truly become one of mindfulness and this bare awareness that is independent and free of clinging, which will transform us and our lives. Thank you.